Interested in the forces shaping our world? The Council on Foreign Relations has you covered. For those who like to look ahead, dive into The World Next Week, hosted by Bob McMahon and Carla Ann Robbins.
We were not forecasting anything about Russian domestic upheaval, and yet that has been the story of the week.
These were scorpions going after each other in a bottle.
And for those who want to go beyond the headlines, join Jim Lindsay as he opens up the president's inbox.
What should U.S. policy do?
The approach towards China, it's enough to make me question bipartisanship.
And finally, join me, Gabrielle Sierra, on Why It Matters, as my guests and I bring some of the world's most compelling stories home to you.
Do you feel good about where we're heading with AI?
Maybe we need to invent a new word here, which kind of is a combination of frightened and excited.
I'm
excited.
So what are you waiting for?
For the world next week, the president's inbox.
And Why It Matters. We'll see you soon.
Israel at war.
400 families, we know only 160 people that survived. It's a massacre.
To call everyone in the Gaza Strip human animals, this is a pretext for ongoing bombardment.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Shirin Jafari. This is The World, an unprecedented attack on Israeli military targets, towns, and homes.
Palestinian militants strike from Gaza, Israel retaliates.
Also on the show, special coverage of Indigenous Peoples Day here in the U.S.
These stories chip away at all kinds of ignorance, and it shows that we're a dynamic culture.
Dynamic cultures that face challenges and are thriving.
All of that today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us today. It is Indigenous Peoples Day here in the U.S. We'll be marking that this hour with my colleague, Shirin Jafari. But we begin with our top story today, the Middle East. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announcing to all Israelis that their country is now at war. This follows the unprecedented coordinated attack on Israel by Hamas militants that began on Saturday morning. That's when militants stormed across the border into Israeli territory from Gaza, killing dozens of people and abducting more than 150 Israelis back into Gaza as hostages. Israelis living in Tel Aviv, some 50 miles north of Gaza, have been sheltering from repeated rocket attacks. Today is the third day of fighting between the Israeli army and Hamas. At least 700 people in Israel are reported dead. Israel has retaliated with airstrikes that so far have killed more than 400 people in Gaza. That's according to local health officials. The World's Duri Biskaran has been following the situation all weekend from Istanbul. Duri, what happened today?
So Israeli forces and Hamas fighters were fighting over control of towns in the south today near the Gaza Strip. Israel is calling up army reserves and moving tanks back towards Gaza in what appears to be preparation for a ground assault. Israeli civilians have been evacuated from that area, and the Israeli military is continuing repeated airstrikes in Gaza. Videos from inside Gaza, like this one from the Wall Street Journal, they show people searching for survivors through the charred rubble of their homes. This airstrike hit a refugee camp. Today, Israel's defense minister said that the country is imposing a complete siege in Gaza. No electricity, no water, no food, no fuel. In this quote, he's saying, "We are fighting human animals, and we will act accordingly." I spoke to Professor Yara Asi. She's a co-director of the Palestine Program for Health and Human Rights. And she says that she fears this dehumanizing language is setting the stage for civilians in Gaza to be killed indiscriminately.
To call everyone in the Gaza Strip human animals, and you don't call a population that unless you are anticipating some extremely harsh moves beyond siege. This is a pretext for ongoing bombardment, starving civilians. How can hospitals function? How can people continue to communicate with the outside world?
Duri, how are people like Yara Asi actually communicating with those in Gaza?
She says 10 of her former students are currently in Gaza. She's struggling to communicate with them via text, and they've been told to evacuate, but there's nowhere to go. Bombing is pretty constant. A lot of people in Gaza, you've got to remember, they don't support Hamas.
Half of the population of the Gaza Strip are youth under the age of 20. These are, aside from the fact that they are children, they did not vote for Hamas, right? They had nothing to do with the situation we are currently in.
She says that Saturday's attack comes on the heels of increasing violence against Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank in recent months.
Duri, also in Gaza right now, there are at least 150 Israelis taken hostage by Hamas militants over the weekend. What do we know about them?
Right. I mean, WhatsApp groups and social media today are just flooded with photos of Israeli families looking for their loved ones. There are also apparently foreigners among the hostages. The hardest part is some people don't know if their relatives were killed on the spot or actually taken alive. They're calling into this Israeli radio program hosted by Yael Dan for help. I mean, they'll say a person's name, a description of what's happened, when they last heard from them, and then their phone number. We know that Hamas militants raided a trance music festival in the Negev Desert, killing hundreds, taking several hostages. They attacked small collective farming communities known as kibbutzes close to the Gaza Strip. One of those kibbutzes is called Nur Oz. There were about 400 people living there. And a young woman named Yafat Zeyler in Tel Aviv told me that she recognized her cousin Shiri in a video on social media, where gunmen are surrounding a young mother holding her two children, a three-year-old and a nine-month-old baby.
There's a photo going around of her holding the two redhead babies. That's her. Her beloved husband as well. We don't know what happened to him, because he's not appearing on the video, and the video is the only proof that we have that they were alive and were taken alive.
And just family after family is going through the exact same thing. Zeyler herself grew up in the Nur Oz kibbutz, and she says her family moved to Israel from Argentina decades ago because of the political situation there. She says Nur Oz is destroyed now.
They burned houses with people inside. They stole everything. They destroyed everything they could. Out of 400 families, we know only now about 160 people that survived. It's a massacre.
She says living on the kibbutz so close to the border with Gaza, the conflict is always on your mind, but it's nuanced. I mean, often kibbutzes will hire Palestinian workers who come over with permits. There's interaction. I mean, people don't hate each other. Her cousin felt really strongly about staying, even when the political situation deteriorated. As far as next steps go, Zeyler says there's been no communication from the Israeli government about any kind of hostage negotiations or contact with Hamas.
And Duri, the peace process, I mean, it was already on ice. What is the sense now of how this fighting is going to impact any hopes for peace in the region going forward?
Right. I mean, this really sets things back quite a bit. In recent years, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has surrounded himself with a very right-wing government, and that's really closed off any efforts towards negotiations or prospects of peace with the Palestinian territories right now. There's a strong peace movement within Israel that has advocated for ending the occupation of Gaza and the West Bank. I spoke with someone from a group called the Pink Front, and they're feeling incredibly demoralized right now. They see this attack as a failure of the Israeli government that's in power, and this violence, this ongoing escalation, it just entrenches this conflict even further.
That's the world's Duri Bhaskara, and we'll be staying on this quickly developing news over the coming days. The rest of the program today we're devoting to Indigenous Peoples Day here in the U.S. Taking us through the balance of the hour is the world's Shirin Jafari. Hi, Shirin.
Hey, Marco. Today is a time to celebrate and explore the history and culture of Native people around the globe, and to recognize the cruel legacy that they still confront today. There are nearly 500 million people worldwide who identify as Indigenous. Of course, there's huge diversity in how Indigenous peoples live. We'll be delving into that in the next hour. But to start, we want to take a look at the term Indigenous itself. Linda Tuhiwai-Smith is a professor of Indigenous education and an eminent Maori scholar. I reached her in Whanganui, New Zealand, and I asked her how she thought about the word Indigenous when she was growing up.
When I grew up, we did not use the word Indigenous. We had words for our tribe, our iwi. We often identified ourselves by our mountain. So one of my mountains is Hikurangi on the east coast of the North Island. We could also define ourselves by a key ancestor. So I think in a, you know, not just for me as a Māori person, but other Indigenous people had their own language for talking about themselves prior to the arrival of colonialism. The moment sort of European colonialism hit our shores, I think our world turned upside down and a whole lot of new language that came to define us entered the vocabulary. And as you know, a lot of that language was very racist, belittling, humiliating.
And so for you, over the decades as a scholar and as a Maori activist, how has your idea of what it is to be Indigenous changed?
The word Indigenous kicks in when we're looking globally at others who are a little bit like us, who share a history of being colonised often, often a minority. We might share particular values and experiences and knowledges.
So given how diverse Indigenous peoples are, do you think it's helpful to cluster these different groups together under the rubric of one single identity?
We can never be one single identity, right? But I think there have been strategic, political reasons why the word Indigenous became the vocabulary of the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. It could also be Native Peoples, but I know here in New Zealand, the word Native had such a negative term. So when I grew up, you know, being called a Native was offensive and insulting to us because of all the negativity and racism that came with that word, even though technically that word might, you know, be apt as a description, the vocabulary used on Indigenous people, it's just been incredibly oppressive and loaded. You know, words like primitive, yeah, native, Aboriginal, you know, those words are words that were put on us. And I think the word Indigenous is a word that various peoples around the world have strategically chosen to describe themselves internationally and maybe nationally. It's not the best word either, and it will evolve, I think, as people kind of find their good space in the places where they currently live. You know, even words like traditional are hugely problematic for us. You know, some people like the idea of traditional knowledge, traditional peoples. But a lot of that vocabulary traps us in the past, limits our ability to develop our cultures, to be innovative, to participate in the world at large. Yeah. And I think one of the things that Māori exemplify is that desire to continue to participate.
How do you hope the next generation will reconsider or redefine Indigenous? What do you hope they might be able to clarify or get closer to?
Well, there's several things we hope for the next generation. Firstly, they don't have to battle for sheer recognition of our existence and of our history and of our contribution and of the way the British and the New Zealand government has treated our people. We hope also that some of the trauma created by colonisation can be healed, that, you know, there can be intergenerational healing. We hope that, you know, the next generations actually speak our language, mm-hmm, don't have to fight to speak our language, mm-hmm, but they actually do. We hope, you know, that they support the struggles of others who have supported us in our struggles, that they have a consciousness about other humans in the world. You know, so there are many sort of aspects of our value system and our knowledge system that we would want the next generations to be not just able to value in a museum sense, but to value because they practice those values.
Linda Tuhiwai-Smith is a longtime professor of Indigenous education and an eminent Maori scholar. She's the author of Decolonizing Methodologies, Research and Indigenous Peoples. She joined us from Whanganui, New Zealand. Linda, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
We'll be right back with more in this special hour dedicated to Indigenous Peoples Day. You're with the world. I'm Shirin Jafari, you're with the world. Thanks for listening to our Indigenous Peoples Day special. In Bolivia, a collective of skateboarders has grabbed global attention. That's partly because of the traditional Andean clothes they wear as they're pulling off tricks. But it's not just about skater style. As the world's Tibisay Seya first reported last year, these indigenous women are trying to uproot some stereotypes in Bolivian society.
When you think of a skater, you probably imagine someone wearing baggy jeans, a loose t-shirt, and maybe a baseball cap. Well, not for this collective of all-female indigenous skateboarders in Bolivia. Instead, they're dressed in a colorful and layered skirt as they practice their kickflips. The skirts are called polleras, and they are traditionally worn by indigenous women in the high mountains of Bolivia. This skirt goes back to the 16th century when Spanish colonizers would impose local women to wear it. Over time, the pollera ended up being a symbol of the Quechua and Aymara ethnic groups in the Andean region of South America, but it's also an object of discrimination.
Yo en lo personal, yo jamás pensé haberme vestido de cholita.
I never would have imagined myself wearing the traditional clothes of a cholita, says Daisy Takuri. Cholita is the word used in Bolivia to refer to indigenous women. Takuri is one of the 9 women with a collective of skateboarders called Imija Skate. Imija means girl in Quechua. They're all in their 20s and come from indigenous backgrounds.
Y en mi familia no me vistió mi mamá jamás, no.
My family never encouraged me to look like a cholita, she says.
Porque ella decía de que no, vivimos en la ciudad y en la ciudad son...
My mother would say, señoritas, women in the city need to wear pants.
Sí, ha habido mucha discriminación, digamos, con la pollera.
Takuri says she and other women in her family have experienced discrimination just for wearing that traditional skirt. Fernando Molina, author of the book Racism in Bolivia, says up until recently, cholitas were second-class citizens. They were socially excluded, denied access to higher education and common spaces or public transportation.
Las personas que hacen el trabajo doméstico, niñeras, cocineras.
Molina says many indigenous women were stuck cleaning houses, cooking, or washing clothes. Indigenous peoples are now recognized in Bolivia's constitution. They have greater political power too, but Molina says the problem of discrimination persists.
Ahora este proyecto no ha funcionado del todo bien porque
he says that didn't work so well because there was a lot of reaction against the empowerment of indigenous peoples, and white remained the dominant class in Bolivia.
Se necesita políticas públicas, discriminación positiva.
Bolivia needs better policies, reparations, and affirmative action to change that, Molina says. It's not only about laws or the constitution, it's how we put them into practice. He says initiatives like the skateboarding collective can help change perceptions. That's happening in the city of Cochabamba, where Daisy Takuri helped create a new skateboarding school.
Incluso tenemos escuelita de skateboarding.
She says more people, especially women, are skateboarding now, and the city is offering more public spaces for skating. And it's not unusual to see women on skateboards wearing polleras, Takuri says. Just come, have fun, and be yourself, she says. It makes us feel empowered. The skateboarding collective appears in a documentary that came out last year. It shows the women traveling across Bolivia, teaching skateboarding to young kids, and of course, wearing polleras. For the world, I'm Tibisay Zea.
Books can make a huge impact on kids as they shape their own views of the world around them. But some young readers don't get to see their lives represented on the page. That's been true for many Indigenous communities across Canada. And one author in British Columbia is working to change that, as the world's Bianca Hillier first reported last year.
23-year-old Ren Louie is a member of the Ahauzit First Nation and was raised in an urban part of Victoria, British Columbia.
Not on reserve or in our home community.
Louie says he remembers flipping through books, looking for stories of Indigenous kids like himself. But they were either written by non-Indigenous authors or portrayed a static version of his community.
It talks about a certain time of Indigenous people, you know, before contact. It makes the assumptions that we still have all of those practices and that kind of lifestyle. After a while, you know, not seeing myself reflected in the books, I felt disengaged with reading.
At home, his family more than made up for this lack of representation. Early on, they taught him about their shared Indigenous culture, including traditional music and songs.
You know, they played in the car and in the house regularly. And when I was 8 years old, I actually, you know, started singing and I got my first drum. And from there, you know, I haven't looked back.
Louie says there was no shortage of teachers. His uncle, grandma, and aunt all helped him learn how to play his 10-inch drum, which was handmade by his mom. He quickly became enticed by the rhythm.
I used to take that drum with me, you know, like when we were going out to the grocery store, I would play the drum. That was just always my thing.
15 years later, Louie still has that very first drum. And he's putting his story down on paper in his debut children's book called Drum from the Heart. The picture book follows a young kid who gains confidence and learns about his culture by singing traditional Nutchalnuth songs. He wrote it during a gap year from college. Louie says it was important to him that the story wasn't rooted in trauma.
These stories chip away at all kinds of ignorance, and it shows that we're a dynamic culture. It shows that we're healthy people, and we're ordinary families.
The illustrations show the young boy playing his drum with his family. Louie hopes the book inspires kids to learn their own culture.
And that's not limited just to Indigenous children, but children from all cultures, from all around the world. You know, whether that's an instrument from their culture or picking up food from their culture and learning how to cook that food. They could talk to their parents and grandparents and learn a little bit more about what their family's done and, you know, try to make that a part of themselves.
For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
We'll hear more from Bianca later in the show, and a whole lot more. It's an Indigenous People's Day special. You're listening to The World. Robbie Robertson was an icon of American rock music, but it was growing up on a reservation in Ontario that shaped him as a songwriter.
I witnessed elders that told stories that just went right deep into my soul.
Plus, how do you protect Indigenous languages? Some are turning to TikTok. That's ahead on The World. I'm Shireen Jafari, and you're listening to The World, a co-production of GBH in Boston and PRX. Many parts of the U.S. are celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day today. To mark the occasion, we're looking at what it means to be Indigenous in different parts of the world and at some of the challenges that these communities face. In Australia, voters are about to decide whether to change the constitution to formally recognize the country's Indigenous peoples for the first time. This constitutional amendment would create a permanent advisory body for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. It would be called the Voice to Parliament, or just the Voice. Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese predicted that this vote would help bring the country together. In reality, the opposite has happened. The political debate around the idea has turned toxic.
Do we want a voice? Absolutely. But we've always had a voice, we've just never been listened to.
No referendum!
What do we want?
Yes!
When do we want it?
Now!
Am I racist, Claire? Is that what you're saying?
That is not true,
Jane.
That is not true.
Millions of Australians that are voting no racist. This is outrageous. The Prime Minister needs to condemn it.
I get it.
In the first of a three-part series, the world's Sarah Bembam reports from Sydney on how this is all playing out.
It's crunch time in Australia. With the referendum just days away, vote yes volunteers are handing out leaflets at an outdoor market in Sydney.
Hey, mate, proudly voting yes.
Urging passers-by to vote for an Indigenous voice to Parliament.
How are you, my friends? Voting yes for a First Nations
yes.
voice?
Yes.
Wonderful. Tell your friends. Thank you.
If this referendum passes, there'd be an advisory body called The Voice, made up of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. The Torres Strait Islands sit north of Australia and are considered part of Queensland. The body would advise Parliament and the executive branch on issues that affect Indigenous communities. But the finer details, like what will this body look like, how will it work, what exactly can it advise on, all of that stuff would be worked out later by Parliament. Jade Apo-Ritchie is a spokesperson for the Yes campaign. She's from the Bunda clan of the Gurangurang Nation. In the past few months, she's been zigzagging the country, making the case for constitutional change.
Having travelled all over Australia and spending time in the remotest of communities in the Northern Territory, I can tell you that every community asks to be heard in some shape or another. And I think it's a human need, a human want to be heard. We have wanted this for a really long time.
She says this is personal for her, a chance for Australians to acknowledge the past and commit to reconciliation.
In my grandparents' day, the government actually told Indigenous people where they could live, who they could marry, where they could work. And then in my father's generation, so he grew up under the White Australia policy. The intention was to assimilate, like basically breed out the black. Get rid of Indigenous culture altogether.
Apo-Ritchie herself grew up celebrating her heritage at home, but hiding it in public. It's enough already, she says.
I want my kids to just be out there really loud and proud about who they are, what their identity is, and to know that they'll have a say over their lives. They will not be governed by harmful policy.
Aboriginal people have lived in Australia for 60,000 years. But the British colonists who arrived in 1788 would go on to describe the land as terra nullius, which means land belonging to nobody. It was a legal fiction used to justify the theft of Aboriginal land over the next 200 years. Aboriginal people were forced off their land and onto missions and reserves. Their lives were regulated and controlled by white administrators who told them where they could go, where they could work, if they could leave, who they could visit, and who they could marry.
The racism here, it really hasn't been recognized in the same way or similar way as the civil rights movement in the States has.
This is Hannah McGlade. She's a Karen Marang woman and teaches Indigenous law at Curtin University Law School in Perth.
My uncle, who's still alive today in his early 80s, remembers a law that said in the city of Perth, you had to be, as a native, they were called, out of the town by 6 o'clock. And if they were not out of town, the police would arrest them and put them in the lockup. Now, the Noongar people, Aboriginal people, would come into town in the day to work as servants for whites, but they had to be out.
The legacy of this racism and dispossession is still felt today. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people make up 3% of Australia's population, but they account for more than a quarter of its prison population. About a third of Indigenous Australians live below the poverty line. Average life expectancy is 8 years lower for Indigenous Australians. In 2008, the government tried to do something about this. Then Prime Minister Kevin Rudd committed to righting the wrongs of the past.
As Prime Minister of Australia, I am sorry. On behalf of the government of Australia, I am sorry.
And that year, the Closing the Gap framework was born. It created a series of targets like cut the gap in high school graduation rates in half by 2020, or cut the gap in employment in half within the decade. Progress has been depressing. The government's Minister for Indigenous Australians, Linda Burney, announced in June that just 4 of the 19 closing the gap targets are on track. She said the latest data show, once again, the status quo is not working.
For far too long, governments have made policies for Indigenous Australians, not with Indigenous Australians. We need a voice to change that.
But changing the Constitution is not easy. There have been 44 constitutional referendums in the country's history, and only 8 have been successful. In order for a referendum to pass, a majority of Australians have to vote for it, and voting is compulsory, and there has to be majority support in 4 out of the 6 Australian states. National opinion polling shows the No campaign has a solid lead. Opponents say there's just not enough detail in the proposal. It's too risky to hardwire something into the Constitution without knowing what it will do.
I don't think most Australians understand it.
Well, when you go out and you ask Australians, what do they know about The Voice? They can't tell you.
You don't know!
And then there's the argument that establishing an advisory body for Indigenous people and only Indigenous people would insert race into the Constitution. Chris Merritt is with the Rule of Law Institute of Australia, a conservative think tank.
Our concern is that this would undermine the principle of equality of citizenship in a way that has never happened before.
Merritt says the constitutional change would give Aboriginal people rights or privileges that others don't have. He says Indigenous people vote. They have representation in Parliament. In fact, there are 11 Indigenous MPs in Parliament, 5% of the total. That's a record for Australia.
No other group in society has the advantage of a special constitutionalized lobby group based on their race to lobby on their behalf. By definition, that's racial preference, and that's abhorrent.
The referendum is this Saturday. No matter the outcome, it's a historic moment for Australia. And for some Indigenous leaders, it's the culmination of a lifetime of advocacy. Here's Hannah McGlade again, Indigenous advocate and professor at Curtin Law School.
This is a process that's now something like 20 years in the making. And, you know, to be honest, we're getting tired.
McGlade says this is the closest Indigenous people have ever come in the long fight for recognition. But if polls are to be believed, they'll have to wait longer still. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum in Sydney.
About 80% of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander population supports The Voice. That's according to polls. But the campaign for a no vote is being led by some prominent Indigenous Australians. Part 2 in our series about the lead-up to the referendum covers the Indigenous case for no. That's later this week. 2 months ago, we lost one of the greats in rock music. Robbie Robertson played guitar with Bob Dylan. He was a foundational member of the band. And he was a member of Six Nations in Canada. Robertson grew up on a reservation in Ontario, and that experience influenced his music and his songwriting. As he explained to Marco Werman a few years ago, Robbie Robertson's upbringing made him stand out.
I guess my heritage was unusual enough. Growing up, you know, when kids would say, you know, yeah, I'm Irish or I'm this or I'm that. And they'd say, and what are you? And I'd say, well, you know, I'm half Indian and half Jewish. And they'd be like, you're what?
When Robertson went solo, his songwriting revealed more of who he is. Songs like Broken Arrow.
Who else is gonna bring you a broken arrow? Who else is gonna bring you a bottle of rain?
But let's go back to 1960, when Robertson was 16. In his memoir Testimony, he talks about grabbing his guitar and hopping on a train for an audition in Arkansas. He wrote, people from my background didn't hardly know how to dream.
You know, in some ways, being from Canada, you know, beside the United States. And the United States seemed like it was the center of the universe. And Canada wasn't. And growing up, you know, with me saying, you know, wow, one of these days I'm going to go out in the world and I'm going to write music and I'm going to perform everywhere and I'm going to do this and do that. And most people looked at me like, you know, that I was just a dreamer and I was just going to get my heart broken. And on my new album, Cinematic, there's a song on there called Dead End Kid that completely refers to this period of, you know, people just saying that doesn't happen for people like us. And I was like, I can't hear you. You know, I'm on a mission.
They said you'll never be nothing. You're just a dead end kid. Probably end up in prison. Or maybe down on the skids.
Dead End Kid, this song, I mean, it gets right at your upbringing. And I mean, like a lot of your music, there's a story there. Do you consider yourself a storyteller? I mean, is it easier to write about, say, Robert E. Lee or the W.S. Walcott Medicine Show, which you have, than it is to write about yourself?
I do consider myself a storyteller, and I learned that at the Six Nations Indian Reserve, you know, that I witnessed elders that told stories that just went right deep into my soul. And I thought, when I grow up, one of these days, I want to be able to do that.
Young faith healer, he's a woman stealer. He will cure by his command.
Now that I don't have the guys in the band with me, I have to share stories. Because when I was working with them, I was really writing songs for them to sing about stories that I wanted to tell. But I was casting them as the singers, as the voices of the story that I wanted to tell.
The late Robbie Robertson there speaking with the world's Marco Werman back in 2019. He's someone who's valued knowledge passed down from elders in his community. Central to that kind of communication is a shared language. There are roughly 7,000 languages in the world today, according to the United Nations. But that number is dwindling fast, especially for indigenous populations. The UN has launched a campaign to protect and fortify indigenous languages across the globe. Local communities are also working on this, and a few of them have found TikTok to be the perfect tool. The world's Bianca Hillier first brought us this story in 2021.
If you know anything about TikTok, you know the algorithm can get to know you really well, really fast. All it took was watching a couple of videos from indigenous creators.
I'm going to say some keywords. First one is wash your hands. Kasi-chi-chi. Repeat after me. Kasi-chi-chi.
My For You page was quickly filled with native languages, including from the folks at the Manitoba Indigenous Cultural Education Center.
Bonjour! Noa Indigenous Kaz, Bawatagon, Ndonji, and Ndanokioma, MICEC.
Noah Malastravich works at the center. He and his colleagues have been teaching Cree and Ojibwe on TikTok since the pandemic began and the center was closed. Their content is relatable and practical. For example, they have a whole series on common small talk.
We're always trying to answer the question, Anin Ejuebak, how's the weather?
As the seasons have changed, they teach people how to answer that question.
Let's go over the word for it's cold out, which is takaya.
And the answer today is Gijidei. Gijidei. It's hot out.
For the weather today, Mispun. Mispun. It's snowing. Mispun anots.
The center staff have continued posting videos like this, even though the center has reopened. Malastravich says that's because of how accessible the content is and how it's uniquely suited for learning a language.
You could rewatch these videos, so it's not like when we used to go to the classes and you'd try to memorize what someone said. So I think if people continue to put material out on TikTok, it's like a library.
A similar library of content is being built around indigenous languages in Mexico.
Time to handle the future tense in Nahuatl. So essentially, you'll have your verb right here, and then you add C to it, to the end.
More than a million people across the country speak Nahuatl today, but on TikTok, millions more are learning the language. vocab lessons are everywhere.
What is a day? Yaukiske. Yaukiske. And that means army.
But fluent speakers aren't the only ones finding an audience. From down in New Zealand, Josh Kirkley is sharing his own journey of learning the Maori language.
Maori words that I've said wrong and they've embarrassed me. Keke, cake, keke, armpit.
Cake and armpit. Close, but not the same. Kirkley is Maori on his dad's side, and he wasn't raised with the culture, so he spent the last 3 years learning the language.
A lot of my videos are not actually me teaching. It's more just what I went through or something that happened. And that's something that you can't Google, you know, what does it feel like to learn Te Reo Māori? There's so many of us, I think, on a really similar journey.
James Wright is another Maori teacher on TikTok. For him, sharing the language is about more than teaching people new words. He hopes it's an entry point for decolonization.
When you learn Te Reo Māori, you learn about the history of it. You learn about laws that were put in place to prevent it from being spoken, the abuse that people suffered in schools because they spoke it.
Wright believes these short videos can be a real tool in revitalizing native languages and normalizing them for those outside of Indigenous communities. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
This hour, we're exploring Indigenous communities across the globe. That includes Crimean Tatars and Indigenous people living on the Crimean Peninsula. The territory was illegally annexed by Russia in 2014, and since the all-out invasion of Ukraine nearly 2 years ago, it's put even more pressure on their lives. The Tatars are an ethnic group predominantly Muslim, and they have lived in Crimea for centuries. The World's Daniel Hoffman spoke with some of them in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv.
Cheburyeki is the Crimean Tatar national dish. They're deep-fried turnovers filled with ground beef or lamb and onions, and they're a specialty here at Irfan Kudusov's restaurant. Kudusov is 54 years old, he's a father of four, and he's a Crimean Tatar activist. The walls of this place are covered in photographs, paintings, postcards, and other objects of cultural significance. The restaurant feels a little like a museum. There's one striking painting with a stork confined in a golden cage. The cage is so tight that the bird can't even spread its wings, Kudusov says. That bird in the cage is like the Crimean Tatar people, he explains. Crimea is golden. It's a beautiful place, he says. But Crimean Tatars who live there are under Russian occupation, and they've lived like that for more than 9 years.
Hello. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
Tamila Tasheva is a Ukrainian government official based in Kyiv. But her role is all about Crimea. She's President Zelensky's special representative for the territory.
I am Crimean Tatar. I am Ukrainian citizen. I born in Uzbekistan. When I 5 years old, I returned with my parents, with my grandmother to Crimea, where my parents even now live in Crimea, in temporary-occupied territory.
Thousands of Crimean Tatars have similar stories. In May 1944, as a result of Stalin's orders, tens of thousands of Crimean Tatars were deported from their native homeland. They were forcibly relocated to Soviet republics in Central Asia. In the process, thousands of Crimean Tatars died.
When Crimean Tatars is deported in 1944, all these Crimean Tatar people in countries of Central Asia, we fight to freedom and fight for returning to Crimea.
In the final years of the Soviet Union, many Crimean Tatars, including Tasheva's family, returned. She says that was a joyful time, but it was not without some difficulties.
It's not easy, of course, because they persecuted Crimean Tatars in the end of 18th and early 90s.
The government made it almost impossible for Crimean Tatars to reclaim lost property. Buying land and building new homes was also difficult. Still, tens of thousands of Crimean Tatars resettled in their homeland as the Soviet Union fell apart and Ukraine gained independence. Life back in Ukraine started feeling normal, but everything changed in 2014. Here's the Milotasheva again.
In 2014, it's really military operation of occupation of territory. And Crimean Tatars do not support Russia because of persecution. Crimean Tatars start to flee in Crimea, but most stay and live in Crimea.
Over the last couple of years, Russia has intensified its crackdown on Crimean Tatar institutions and civil society. Tasheva says more than 150 Crimean Tatars are now locked up in Russian prisons.
Ukrainian state don't have access to Crimea, but of course we have a lot of communication and connection with our people. And of course we support our people. For us, very important to maintain some connections between Crimea and mainland of Ukraine.
Back at Irfan Kudusov's restaurant, he explains the irony of his life as a Crimean Tatar living in the Ukrainian capital.
У нас люди в оккупации живут, а мы здесь, да? Мы как бы на свободе, но не дома. Они дома, но не на свободе. Такой парадокс.
We have our freedom, but not our home, he tells me. While Crimean Tatars still in Crimea have their home, but they don't have freedom. Kudusov brings up the painting with the stork again, the bird trapped in a golden cage.
Это мне говорит опыт не только мой сегодняшний, да, человека, которому 54 года, а и опыт моего отца.
He says his family waited for decades to return to Crimea. And they did, back in the early 90s. And now, once more, he says he has no doubt that Crimean Tatars driven out by the Russian invasion will return as well. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman, Kyiv, Ukraine.
Before we end our special today, Marco Werman joins me again for a quick recap of our top story.
Thank you, Shirin. Israel has said it will use enormous force against Palestinian militants for the worst attack on Israeli soil in decades. The Israeli military says it's already carried out one of the largest airstrikes ever in retaliation. And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that the counterattack has only just begun. Since the surprise Hamas attack on Saturday, more than 700 people have been killed in Israel, with some 600 people being killed in Gaza in Israeli counterstrikes. We'll continue to follow the story in the coming days, as well as all the other news from around the globe.
Finally today, some music from Taiwan, inspired by the sounds of birds, bees, and waterfalls. David Darling is a classically trained American cellist. He had heard about an indigenous community in Taiwan called Bonun. Darling, who died 2 years ago, was captivated by their music and traveled to Taiwan to meet with the Bonun, with the goal of performing with them on his cello. The Bonun singers agreed, and we leave you today with the sounds of that encounter. Thanks for listening to this special episode of The World on Indigenous Peoples Day. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston, I'm Shirin Jafari. See you back here tomorrow.